robbers and stick-up men and other desperados. The passage of Prohibition had only compounded the territory's feeling of lawlessness by encouraging organized crime and creating, in the words of one historian, the greatest criminal bonanza in American history. And few places in the country were as chaotic as Osage County, where the unwritten codes of the West, the traditions that bound communities, had unraveled. By one account, the amount of oil money had surpassed the total value of all the Old West gold rushes combined, and this fortune had drawn every breed of miscreant from across the country. A U.S. Justice Department official warned that there were more fugitives hiding out in the Osage Hills than perhaps any other county in the state or any state in the Union. Among them was the hard-boiled stick-up man Irvin Thompson, who was known as Blackie, maybe because of his dark complexion, he was a quarter Cherokee, or maybe because of his dark heart. A lawman described him as the meanest man I ever handled. Even more notorious was Al Spencer, the so-called Phantom Terror, who had made the transition from galloping horses to speeding getaway cars, and had inherited from Jesse James the title of the region's most infamous outlaw. The Arizona Republican said that Spencer, with his diseased mind and a misguided love of adventure, appealed to the portion of the population of the country that fed on false idolatry. Members of his gang, including Dick Gregg and Frank Jelly Nash, were themselves ranked among the most dreaded outlaws of the day. A more unnerving theory about Anna's death was that her killer was living among them in sheep's clothing. Molly and others began to harbor suspicions about Anna's ex-husband, Oda Brown, who called himself a businessman but spent most of his time carousing. In retrospect, his distraught manner had seemed almost too theatrically intense. An investigator wrote in his notes, "This may have been real grief or for effect." After Anna had divorced him, she had denied him any inheritance, leaving virtually all of her fortune to Lizzie. Since the burial, Brown had hired a lawyer and had tried unsuccessfully to contest the will. The investigator concluded that Brown was absolutely no good and capable of doing almost anything for money. Several weeks after the funeral, a man who'd been arrested in Kansas for check forgery sent a letter to Sheriff Frias claiming that he had information concerning Anna's murder. "Honorable Sir," he wrote, "I hope to be some assistance to you." He didn't divulge what he knew, however, and upon receiving the message, the sheriff set out in what the press described as a fast automobile. Hale, who had been tipped off regarding the potential breakthrough, rushed to the jail as well. Under interrogation, the forger, a fidgety 28-year-old man, claimed that Brown had paid him $8,000 to murder Anna. He described how he'd shot her in the head, then carried her body in his arms down to the creek. Soon after his confession, a posse of lawmen swept in and seized Brown when he was in Pawhuska on business. The Pawhuska Daily Capital heralded the news. "Anna Brown's slayer confesses crime." It added, "Oda Brown, husband of woman, also arrested." Molly and her family were devastated by the notion that Oda was responsible for Anna's murder, but they could take solace in the thought of his facing justice, perhaps the hangman's noose or the electric chair. But within days, authorities had conceded that there was no evidence to support the forger's claims, no evidence that he had been in Osage County at the time of the murder, or that Brown had ever contacted him. The authorities had no choice but to release Brown.
"There's a lot of talk," the sheriff was quoted as saying, "but you have to have proof, not talk."
Like many officials, the county prosecutor owed his election at least in part to Hale. When he first ran for office, his advisors told him that he had to get Hale's endorsement, and so he made several trips to Hale's ranch. He could never find him, and finally a cattle inspector told him, "If you want to see Bill Hale, you will have to get to his ranch early, and I mean damned early." So, at 3 a.m, the attorney parked his Model T at the ranch and went to sleep in the car. Before long, he was jolted awake by a fierce-looking man pressed against his window, demanding to know why he was trespassing. It was William Hale. The attorney explained his purpose, and Hale realized that he knew the attorney's parents, who had once sheltered him during a blizzard. Hale promised to turn out the vote for him. One of the attorney's advisors remarked that Hale would not lie to anyone, and if he said he would do something, he would do it. On election day, the attorney carried every single precinct in that part of the county. Hale had remained close with the county prosecutor and conferred with him and other officials about Anna's murder. Eventually, the county prosecutor decided to look again for the bullet that had eluded investigators during Anna's autopsy. A court order was obtained to unbury Anna. Scott Mathis, the Big Hill Trading Company owner who was friends with Hale and Molly, was asked to supervise the grim task, and he went to the cemetery with his undertaker and a grave digger. The grass on Anna's plot had barely had time to grow back. The men began to prod the unforgiving earth with their spades, then reached down and lifted up the once white casket, now dirt-blackened, and forced open the lid. An awful vapor, death itself, filled the air. The Schoen brothers, who had performed the first autopsy, appeared at the cemetery and renewed their search for the bullet. This time, the brothers put on gloves and took out a meat cleaver, cutting Anna's head into sausage meat, as the undertaker later put it. But once again, the brothers found nothing. The bullet appeared to have vanished. By July 1921, the Justice of the Peace had closed his inquiries, stating that Anna Brown's death had come at the hands of parties unknown, the same finding as delivered in the Whitehorn inquest. The justice locked away in his office the little evidence that he'd gathered in case more information emerged. Meanwhile, Lizzie, who'd once possessed the same energy and stubborn determination as Molly, had grown sicker. Each day she seemed to drift further away, to become more insubstantial. It was as if she had the same peculiar wasting illness that had consumed Minnie. Desperate for help, Molly turned to the Osage medicine men, who chanted when the eastern sky was red like blood, and to the new breed of medicine men, the Schoen brothers, who carried their potions in black bags. Nothing seemed to work. Molly kept vigil over her mother, one of the last tethers to the tribe's ancient way of life. Molly could not cure her, but she could feed her, and she could brush her long, beautiful, silvery hair from her face, a face that was lined and expressive, that maintained its aura. One day that July, less than 2 months after Anna's murder, Lizzie stopped breathing. Molly couldn't revive her. Lizzie's spirit had been claimed by Jesus Christ, the Lord and Savior, and by Wakonda, the great mystery. Molly was overwhelmed with grief. As the Osage morning prayer went, "Have pity on me, O Great Spirit. You see I cry forever. Dry my eyes and give me comfort." Molly's brother-in-law, Bill Smith, was one of the first to wonder if there was something curious about Lizzie's death, coming so soon after the murders of Anna and Whitehorn. A bruising bulldog of a man, Bill had also expressed deep frustration over the authorities' investigation, and he had begun looking into the matter himself. Like Molly, he was struck by the peculiar vagueness of Lizzie's sickness. No doctor had ever pinpointed what was causing it. Indeed, no one had uncovered any natural cause for her death. The more Bill delved, conferring with doctors and local investigators, the more he was certain that Lizzie had died of something dreadfully unnatural. She'd been poisoned. And Bill was sure that all three deaths were connected somehow to the Osage's subterranean reservoir of black gold. 4. Underground Reservation. The money had come suddenly, swiftly, madly. Molly had been 10 years old when the oil was first discovered, had witnessed firsthand the ensuing frenzy. But as the elders of the tribe had relayed to Molly, the tangled history of how their people had gotten hold of this oil-rich land went back to the 17th century, when the Osage had laid claim to much of the central part of the country, a territory that stretched from what is now Missouri and Kansas to Oklahoma, and still farther west, all the way to the Rockies. In 1803, President Thomas Jefferson purchased from the French the territory of Louisiana, which contained lands dominated by the Osage. Jefferson informed his Secretary of the Navy that the Osage were a great nation, and that "we must stand well because in their quarter we are miserably weak." In 1804, a delegation of Osage chiefs met with Jefferson at the White House. He told the Navy Secretary that the Osage, whose warriors typically stood well over 6 feet tall, were the finest men we have ever seen. At the meeting, Jefferson addressed the chiefs as "my children," and said, "It is so long since our forefathers came from beyond the great water that we have lost the memory of it, and seem to have grown out of this land as you have done. We are all now of one family." He went on, "On your return, tell your people that I take them all by my hand, that I become their father hereafter, that they shall know our nation only as friends and benefactors." But within 4 years, Jefferson had compelled the Osage to relinquish their territory between the Arkansas River and the Missouri River. The Osage chief stated that his people had no choice but must either sign the treaty or be declared enemies of the United States. Over the next 2 decades, the Osage were forced to cede nearly 100 million acres of their ancestral land, ultimately finding refuge in a 50-by-125-mile area in southeastern Kansas. And it was in this place where Molly's mother and father had come of age. Molly's father, who was born around 1844, went by his Osage name, Nekashe. A young Osage man then typically wore fringed buckskin leggings and moccasins and a breechcloth. A finger-woven belt held his tobacco pouch and tomahawk. His chest was often bare, and his head was shaved except for a strip of hair that ran from the crown to his neck
and that stood straight up like the crest of a Spartan's helmet. Along with other warriors, Nekashe defended the tribe from attacks, and before heading into battle he would have painted his face black with charcoal and prayed to Wakonda, confirming that it was time, as the Osage put it, to make the enemy lie reddened on the earth. As Nekashe grew older, he became a prominent figure in the tribe. Deliberate and thoughtful, he had an ability to study each situation before choosing a course of action. Years later, when the tribe created its first court system, which adjudicated mostly minor crimes, he was elected one of the three judges. Lizzie also grew up on the reservation in Kansas, where she helped to provide for her family, harvesting corn and hauling wood over distances. She wore moccasins, leggings, a cloth skirt, and a blanket around her shoulders, and she painted the part in the middle of her hair red to symbolize the path of the sun. An Indian Affairs agent would later describe her as industrious and a person of good character. Twice a year, when Lizzie and Nekashe were young, their families and the rest of the tribe would pack their few earthly possessions, clothing, bedding, blankets, utensils, dried meat, weapons, lash them to horses, and set out on a sacred 2-month buffalo hunt. When a scouting party spotted a herd, Nekashe and the other hunters raced on their horses across the plains, the hooves pounding the earth like drums, the manes whipping the riders' sweating, gleaming faces. A French medical student who accompanied the tribe on a hunt in 1840 said, "The race is a merciless one. Once the bison is reached, the animal tries to escape in another direction. He doubles to deceive his enemy, then seeing himself overtaken, he becomes enraged and turns against his aggressor." Nekashe would coolly draw his bow and arrow, which the Osage considered more effective than a bullet. When a bison was fatally wounded, the medical student recalled, the beast vomits torrents of blood and falls to its knees before sinking to the ground. After the tail was cut off, as a trophy for the conqueror, nothing was left to waste. The meat was dried, the heart smoked, the intestines made into sausages. Oils from the bison's brain were rubbed over the hide, which was then transformed into leather for robes and lodge coverings. And still there was more to reap. Horns were turned into spoons, sinews into bowstrings, tallow into fuel for torches. When an Osage chief was asked why he didn't adopt the white man's ways, he replied, "I am perfectly content with my condition. The forests and rivers supply all the calls of nature in plenty." The Osage had been assured by the U.S. government that their Kansas territory would remain their home forever. But before long, they were under siege from settlers. Among them was the family of Laura Ingalls Wilder, who later wrote Little House on the Prairie based on her experiences. "Why don't you like Indians, Ma?" Laura asks her mother in one scene. "I just don't like them. And don't lick your fingers, Laura." "This is Indian country, isn't it?" Laura said. "What did we come to their country for if you don't like them?" One evening, Laura's father explains to her that the government will soon make the Osage move away. "That's why we're here, Laura. White people are going to settle all this country, and we get the best land because we get here first and take our pick." Though in the book the Ingallses leave the reservation under threat of being removed by soldiers, many squatters began to take the land by force. In 1870, the Osage, expelled from their lodges, their graves plundered, agreed to sell their Kansas lands to settlers for $1.25 an acre. Nevertheless, impatient settlers massacred several of the Osage, mutilating their bodies and scalping them. An Indian Affairs agent said, "The question will suggest itself, which of these people are the savages?" The Osage searched for a new homeland. They debated purchasing nearly 1.5 million acres from the Cherokee in what was then Indian Territory, a region south of Kansas that had become an endpoint on the Trail of Tears for many tribes ousted from their lands. The unoccupied area that the Osage were eyeing was bigger than Delaware, but most whites regarded the land as broken, rocky, sterile, and utterly unfit for cultivation, as one Indian Affairs agent put it, which is why Watyanka, an Osage chief, stood at the council meeting and said, "My people will be happy in this land. White man cannot put iron thing in ground here. White man will not come to this land. There are many hills here. White man does not like country where there are hills, and he will not come." He went on, "If my people go west where land is like floor of lodge, white man will come to our lodges and say, 'We want your land.' Soon land will end, and Osages will have no home." So the Osage bought the territory for 70 cents per acre and, in the early 1870s, began their exodus. The air was filled with cries of the old people, especially the women who lamented over the graves of their children, which they were about to leave forever, a witness said. After completing their trek to the new reservation, members of the tribe built several camps, the most significant one being in Pawhuska, where, on a prominent hilltop, the Office of Indian Affairs erected an imposing sandstone building for its field office. Gray Horse, in the western part of the territory, consisted of little more than a cluster of newly built lodges, and it was here where Lizzie and Nekashe, who married in 1874, settled. The series of forced migrations, along with such white man's diseases as smallpox, had taken a tremendous toll on the tribe. By one estimate, its population dwindled to about 3,000, a third of what it had been 70 years earlier. The Indian Affairs agent reported, "This little remnant is all that remains of a heroic race that once held undisputed ownership over all this region." Although the Osage still went on buffalo hunts, they were chasing not only food, but the past. It was like life in the old days, a white trader who accompanied them recalled. The old men of the band were wont to gather about the campfires in a reminiscent mood, and there recount the tales of prowess on the warpath and in the chase. By 1877, there were virtually no more American buffalo to hunt, a development hastened by the authorities who encouraged settlers to eradicate the beasts, knowing that, in the words of an army officer, "Every buffalo dead is an Indian gone." U.S. policy toward the tribes shifted from containment to forced assimilation, and officials increasingly tried to turn the Osage into church-going, English-speaking, fully clothed tillers of the soil. The government owed the tribe annuity payments for the sale of its Kansas land, but refused to distribute them until able-bodied men like Nekashe took up farming. And even then, the government insisted on making the payments in the form of clothing and food rations. An Osage chief complained, "We are not dogs that we should be fed like dogs." unaccustomed to the white man's agricultural methods and deprived of buffalo, the Osage began to go hungry. Their bones soon looked as if they might break through their skin. Many members of the tribe died. An Osage delegation, including the chief Watianka, was urgently dispatched to Washington, D.C., to petition the Commissioner of Indian Affairs to abolish the ration system. According to an account by John Joseph Matthews, members of the delegation wore their best blankets and leggings, while Watianka wrapped himself in a red blanket so entirely that you could see little more than his eyes, dark wells that burned with an entire history. The delegation went to the commissioner's office and waited for him. When the commissioner arrived, he informed an interpreter, "Tell these gentlemen that I am sorry that I have another appointment at this time. I am sorry I had forgotten about it until just now." As the commissioner tried to leave, Watianka blocked his path to the door and let go of his blanket. To the shock of even his fellow Osage, he was naked except for his breechcloth and his moccasins, and his face was painted as if he were leading a war party. He stood there towering like some primitive god of the dark forests, Matthews wrote. Watianka told the interpreter, "Tell this man to sit down." When the commissioner complied, Watianka said, "We have come a long way to talk about this." The commissioner said, "Surely this man who doesn't know how to act, who comes to my office almost naked with war paint on his face, is not civilized enough to know how to use money." Watianka said that he was not ashamed of his body, and after he and the delegation pressed their case, the commissioner agreed to end the ration policy. Watianka picked up his blanket and said, "Tell this man it is all right now. He can go." Like many others in the tribe, Molly's parents tried to hold on to their customs. Bestowing a name was one of the most important Osage rituals. Only then was someone considered a person by the tribe. Molly, who was born on December 1, 1886, was given the Osage name Wakonta Hiumpa. Her sisters were also known by Osage names. Anna was Waralampa. Minnie was Wajaji. And Rita, Mesemoy. But the process of acculturation was accelerating as settlers began to move on to the reservation. They didn't look like the Osage, or even like the Cheyenne or the Pawnee. They seemed unwashed and desperate, like William Hale, who would eventually appear on his horse in his ragged clothes, this man from nowhere. Even settlers like Hale, who formed close ties to the Osage, argued that the white man's road was inevitable, and that the only way for the Osage to survive was to follow it. Hale was determined to transform not only himself, but the wilderness from which he came, to cross-fence the open prairie and to create a network of trading posts and towns. In the 1880s, John Florer, a Kansas frontiersman who referred to Osage territory as God's country, established the first trading post in Gray Horse. Molly's father, Nekashe, liked to linger outside it in the shade and sell animal pelts, and Molly got to know the son of a trader who was one of the first white people she'd ever seen. His skin was as pale as the belly of a fish. The trader's son kept a journal, and in it he noted a profound existential change experienced by Molly and her family, though he remarked upon it only in passing, as if it were no more than a new item on a ledger. One day, he said, A trader began to refer to Nekashe as Jimmy. Soon other traders began to call Molly's father Jimmy, and before long it had supplanted his Osage name. Likewise, his daughters, who often visited the store, received their names thereof, the trader's son wrote. And that's how Wakonta Hiumpa became Molly. Molly, who, like her mother, then wore leggings, moccasins, a skirt, a blouse, and a blanket, slept on the floor in a corner of her family's lodge and had to do many grueling chores. But there was a relative peacefulness and happiness to that time. Molly could enjoy the ceremonial dances and the feasts and playing water tag in the creek and watching the men race their ponies in the emerald fields. As the trader's son wrote, "There lingers memories like a half-forgotten dream of an enchanting world dawning on a child's consciousness in its wonder and mystery." In 1894, when Molly was 7, her parents were informed that they had to enroll her in the St. Louis School, a Catholic boarding institution for girls that had been opened in Pawhuska, which was 2 days' journey by wagon to the northeast. An Indian Affairs commissioner had said, "The Indian must conform to the white man's ways peacefully if they will, forcibly if they must." Molly's parents were warned that if they didn't comply, the government would withhold its annuity payments, leaving the family starving. And so, one morning in March, Molly was taken from her family and bundled into a horse-drawn wagon. As she and a driver set out toward Pawhuska, in the center of the reservation, Molly could see Gray Horse, the seeming limit of her universe, gradually disappear until all that was visible was the smoke rising from the tops of the lodges and fading into the sky. In front of her, the prairie stretched to the horizon like an ancient seabed. There were no settlements, no souls. It was as if she'd slipped over the edge of the world and fallen, to borrow Willa Cather's phrase, outside man's jurisdiction. Hour after hour, mile after mile, lurching back and forth in the wagon, Molly crossed the wild, empty landscape not yet carved into a country. Eventually, the light began to fail, and the driver and Molly had to stop and set up camp. When the sun sank below the prairie floor, the sky would turn blood red, and then black, the density of the darkness diluted only by the moon and the stars, from where the Osage believed that many of their clans descended. Molly had become a traveler in the mist. She was surrounded by the forces of night, heard but not seen. The gibbering of coyotes and the howling of wolves and the screaming of owls, which were said to carry an evil spirit. The next day, the monochrome prairies gave way to timber-covered hills, and Molly and her driver rode up and down the slopes, past shadowy blackjacks and sunless caves, perfect places, as an Indian Affairs agent once fretted, for ambush. He added, "Let me tell you, there are ignorant criminals who would do anything." They rode until they came upon a sign of human habitation. A single-story, dilapidated, red-painted wooden structure. It was an Osage trading store, and nearby was a grubby rooming house and a blacksmith shop with an immense pile of horseshoes. The muddy trail turned into a wider, even muddier trail, with a scattering of trading stores on either side. These businesses had sagging duckboards out front to help customers avoid the treacherous mud, and hitching posts for horses and weather-beaten facades that looked as if they might tumble over in the breeze, some of them with trompe-l'oeil second stories to create an illusion of grandeur. Molly had reached Pawhuska. Although the reservation's capital then seemed a small, squalid place, a muddy little trading post, as one visitor described it, it was likely the biggest settlement Molly had ever seen. She was taken about a mile away to a forbidding stone building that stood four stories high. The St. Louis Catholic Missionary School, where she was left in the care of women in black and white habits. Molly went through the front door. Matthews once described the entrance to another Osage boarding school as a big black mouth, bigger and darker than a wildcat's, and down a labyrinth of drafty corridors. Coal lanterns glowed in the darkness. Molly had to remove the Indian blanket from her shoulders and put on a plain dress. She wasn't allowed to speak Osage. She had to catch the white man's tongue, and was given a Bible that began with a distinct notion of the universe. Then God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. Each hour of the day was regimented, and students were lined up and marched from point to point. They were taught piano, penmanship, geography, and arithmetic. The world distilled into strange new symbols. The instruction was intended to assimilate Molly into white society and transform her into what the authorities conceived of as the ideal woman. So while Osage boys at other institutions learned farming and carpentry, Molly was trained in the domestic arts: sewing, baking, laundering, and housekeeping. It is impossible to overestimate the importance of careful training for Indian girls, a U.S. government official had stated, adding, "Of what avail is it that the man be hard-working and industrious, providing by his labor food and clothing for his household, if the wife, unskilled in cookery, unused to the needle, with no habits of order or neatness, makes what might be a cheerful, happy home only a wretched abode of filth and squalor? It is the women who cling most tenaciously to heathen rites and superstitions, and perpetuate them by their instructions to the children." Many Osage students at Molly's school tried to flee, but lawmen chased after them on horseback and bound them with ropes, hauling them back. Molly attended class 8 months a year, and when she did return to Gray Horse, she noticed that more and more girls had stopped wearing their blankets and moccasins, and that the young men had exchanged their breechcloths for trousers and their scalp locks for broad-brimmed hats. Many students began to feel embarrassed by their parents, who didn't understand English and still lived by the old ways. An Osage mother said of her son, "His ears are closed to our talk." Molly's family was straddling not only two centuries, but two civilizations. Her family's distress increased in the late 1890s as the U.S. government intensified its push for the culmination of its assimilation campaign, allotment. Under the policy, the Osage Reservation would be divvied up into 160-acre parcels, into real estate, with each tribal member receiving one allotment, while the rest of the territory would be opened to settlers. The allotment system, which had already been imposed on many tribes, was designed to end the old communal way of life and turn American Indians into private property owners, a situation that would, not incidentally, make it easier to procure their land. The Osage had seen what had happened to the Cherokee outlet, a vast prairie that was part of the Cherokees' territory and was near the western border of the Osage Reservation. After the U.S. government purchased the land from the Cherokee, It had announced that at noon on September 16, 1893, a settler would be able to claim one of the 42,000 parcels of land if he or she got to the spot first. For days before the starting date, tens of thousands of men, women, and children had come from as far away as California and New York and gathered along the boundary. The ragged, dirty, desperate mass of humanity stretched across the horizon like an army pitted against itself. Finally, after several Sooners who'd tried to sneak across the line early had been shot, the starting gun sounded. A race for land such as was never before witnessed on Earth, as one newspaper put it. A reporter wrote, "Men knocked each other down as they rushed onward. Women shrieked and fell fainting, only to be trampled and perhaps killed." The reporter continued, "Men, women, and horses were laying all over the prairie. Here and there, men were fighting to the death over claims which each maintained he was first to reach. Knives and guns were drawn. It was a terrible and exciting scene. No pen can do it justice. It was a struggle where the game was emphatically every man for himself and devil take the hindmost." By nightfall, the Cherokee outlet had been carved into pieces. Because the Osage had purchased their land, it was harder for the government to impose its policy of allotment. The tribe, led by one of its greatest chiefs, James Bigheart, who spoke seven languages, among them Sioux, French, English, and Latin, and who had taken to wearing a suit, was able to forestall the process. But pressure was mounting. Theodore Roosevelt had already warned what would befall an Indian who refused his allotment. "Let him, like these whites who will not work, perish from the face of the earth which he cumbers." By the early 20th century, Big Heart and other Osage knew that they could no longer avoid what a government official called the Great Storm Gathering. The U.S. government planned to break up Indian territory and make it a part of what would be a new state called Oklahoma. In the Choctaw language, Oklahoma means red people. Big Heart had succeeded in delaying the process for several years. The Osage were the last tribe in Indian territory to be allotted, and this had given the Osage more leverage, as government officials were eager to avoid any final impediments to statehood. In 1904, Big Heart sent a zealous young lawyer named John Palmer across the country to keep his finger on the Washington pulse. The orphaned son of a white trader and a Sioux woman, Palmer had been adopted as a child by an Osage family and had since married an Osage woman. A U.S. senator from Oklahoma called Palmer the most eloquent Indian alive. For months, Big Heart and Palmer and other members of the tribe negotiated with the government officials over the terms of allotment. The Osage prevailed upon the government to divide the land solely among members of the tribe, thereby increasing each individual's allotment from 160 acres to 657 acres. This strategy would avoid a mad dash on their territory, though whites could then attempt to buy allotments from tribe members. The Osage also managed to slip into the agreement what seemed at the time like a curious provision: that the oil, gas, coal, or other minerals covered by the lands are hereby reserved to the Osage tribe. The tribe knew that there were some oil deposits under the reservation. More than a decade earlier, an Osage Indian had shown John Florer, the owner of the trading post in Gray Horse, a rainbow sheen floating on the surface of a creek in the eastern part of the reservation. The Osage Indian dabbed his blanket at the spot and squeezed the liquid into a container. Flora thought that the liquid smelled like the axle grease sold in his store, and he rushed back and showed the sample to others, who confirmed his suspicions. It was oil. With the tribe's approval, Flora and a wealthy banking partner obtained a lease to begin drilling on the reservation. Few imagined that the tribe was sitting on a fortune, but by the time of the allotment negotiations, several small wells had begun operating, and the Osage shrewdly managed to hold on to this last realm of their land, a realm that they could not even see. After the terms of the Allotment Act were agreed upon in 1906, Palmer boasted to Congress, "I wrote that Osage agreement out in longhand." Like others on the Osage tribal roll, Molly and her family members each received a headright, essentially a share in the tribe's mineral trust. When, the following year, Oklahoma entered the Union as the 46th state, members of the tribe were able to sell their surface land in what was now Osage County. But to keep the mineral trust under tribal control, no one could buy or sell headrights. These could only be inherited. Molly and her family had become part of the first underground reservation. The tribe soon began leasing areas to more and more white prospectors for exploration. Molly saw workers, tool dressers, rope chokers, mule peelers, gang pushers, toiling furiously. After lowering a torpedo filled with nitroglycerin into the belly of the earth, the muddied workers would detonate it, occasionally turning up a fragment of an ancient American Indian spear or an arrowhead. They'd stare at it in bewilderment. These men built wooden structures that ascended into the sky like temples, and they chanted their own private language. "Bounce, you cats, bounce. Load up on them hooks, you snappers. That's high. Ring her off, collar pecker. Up on the mops. Out, growler board." Many wildcatters dug dry wells or dusters and scurried away in despair. An Osage remarked that such white men act like tomorrow they ain't gonna be no more war. In the early 20th century, George Getty, an attorney from Minneapolis, began his family's quest for oil in the eastern part of Osage Territory on a parcel of land, Lot 50, that he'd leased for $500. When his son, Jean-Paul Getty, was a boy, he visited the area with him. "It was pioneer days," Jean-Paul, who founded the Getty Oil Company, later recalled. "No motor cars, very few telephones, not many electric lights. Even though it was the beginning of the 20th century, you still very much felt the influence of the 19th century." He went on. "It seemed a great adventure. My parents never saw the charm of it all that I did. We used to go often to Lot 50, about 9 miles into the Osage, in a horse-drawn wagon. It took a couple of hours, and we had to cross a river to get there." Before encountering the Indians, Jean-Paul had asked his father, "Are they dangerous? Will we have to fight them off?" His father laughed. "No," he said. "They're rather quiet and peaceful." One damp spring day in 1917, Frank Phillips, a wildcatter who'd previously sold a tonic to prevent baldness, was out with his workers on Lot 185, less than half a mile from Lot 50. They were on a platform drilling when the derrick began to tremble, as if a locomotive were rushing by. From the hole in the ground came a rumbling, gurgling sound, and the workers began to run, their screams smothered by what had become a roar. A driller grabbed Phillips and pulled him off the platform just as the earth burst open and a black column of oil spewed into the air. Each new find seemed more breathtaking than the last. In 1920, E. W. Marland, who was once so poor that he couldn't afford train fare, discovered Burbank, one of the highest-producing oil fields in the United States. A new well generated 680 barrels in its first 24 hours. Many of the Osage would rush to see a gusher when it erupted, scrambling for the best view, making sure not to cause a spark, their eyes following the oil as it shot 50, 60, sometimes 100 feet in the air. With its great black wings of spray arcing above the rigging, it rose before them like an angel of death. The spray coated the fields and the flowers and smeared the faces of the workers and the spectators. Still, people hugged and tossed their hats in celebration. Big Heart, who had died not long after the imposition of allotment, was hailed as the Osage Moses. And the dark, slimy, smelly mineral substance seemed like the most beautiful thing in the world. 5. The Devil's Disciples. Money was the one means at Molly's disposal that might induce the indifferent white authorities to pursue a killer of Indians. After Lizzie died in July 1921, Molly's brother-in-law, Bill Smith, had presented his suspicions to authorities that she'd been slowly poisoned, but by August they had still not looked into the case. Nor had any progress been made in the then 3-month-old probe of Anna's murder. To prod investigators, Molly's family issued a statement saying that because of the foulness of the crime and the dangers that exist to other people, they were offering a $2,000 cash reward for any information leading to the apprehension of those responsible. The Whitehorn family also offered a $2,500 reward to catch Charles's slayers. And William Hale, who campaigned for stamping out the criminal element from Osage County, promised his own reward to anyone who caught the killers, dead or alive. "We've got to stop this bloody business," he said. But the situation with law enforcement continued to deteriorate. The Oklahoma Attorney General soon charged Sheriff Frias with willfully failing to enforce the law by permitting bootlegging and gambling. Frias denied the allegations, and while the case awaited trial, these two powerful lawmen were pitted against each other. Given this turmoil, Hale announced that it was time to hire a private eye. During much of the 19th and early 20th centuries, private detective agencies had filled the vacuum left by decentralized, underfunded, incompetent, and corrupt sheriff and police departments. In literature and in the popular imagination, the all-seeing private eye, the gumshoe, the cinder dick, the sleuth hound, the shadow, displaced the crusading sheriff as the archetype of rough justice. He moved across the dangerous new frontiers of deep alleyways and roiling slums. His signature was not the smoking six-shooter. Instead, like Sherlock Holmes, he relied upon the startling powers of reason and deduction, the ability to observe what the Watsons of the world merely saw. He found order in a scramble of clues and, as one author put it, turned brutal crimes, the vestiges of the beast in man, into intellectual puzzles. Yet from the outset, the fascination with private detectives was mixed with aversion. They were untrained and unregulated and often had criminal records themselves. Beholden to paying clients, they were widely seen as surreptitious figures who burglarized people's secrets. The term to detect derived from the Latin verb to unroof, and because the devil, according to legend, allowed his henchmen to peer voyeuristically into houses by removing their roofs, detectives were known as the Devil's Disciples. In 1850, Alan Pinkerton founded the first American private detective agency. In advertisements, the company's motto, "We Never Sleep," was inscribed under a large, unblinking, Masonic-like eye, which gave rise to the term private eye. In a manual of general principles and rules that served as a blueprint for the industry, Pinkerton admitted that the detective must at times depart from the strict line of truth and resort to deception. Yet even many people who despised the profession deemed it a necessary evil. As one private eye put it, he might be a miserable snake, but he was also the silent, secret, and effective avenger of the outraged majesty of the law when everything else fails. Hale recruited a brooding private detective from Kansas City who went by the name of Pike. To preserve his cover, Pike, who smoked a corncob pipe and had a smudge of a mustache, met Hale at a concealed spot near Whizbang. Civic leaders like Hale considered the name Whizbang undignified and instead called the town Denoya, after a prominent Osage family. As smoke from the oil fields melted into the sky, Hale conferred with Pike. Then Pike slipped away to pursue his investigation. At the direction of Molly and her family, Anna's estate also hired private detectives. The estate was being administered by Scott Mathis, the Big Hill Trading Company owner who had long managed the financial affairs for Anna and Lizzie as a guardian. The U.S. government, contending that many Osage were unable to handle their money, had required the Office of Indian Affairs to determine which members of the tribe it considered capable of managing their trust funds. Over the tribe's vehement objections, many Osage, including Lizzie and Anna, were deemed incompetent and were forced to have a local white guardian overseeing and authorizing all of their spending, down to the toothpaste they purchased at the corner store. One Osage who had served in World War I complained, "I fought in France for this country, and yet I am not allowed even to sign my own checks." The guardians were usually drawn from the ranks of the most prominent white citizens in Osage County. Mathis put together a team of private eyes, as did the estate for Whitehorn. The private detectives investigating the Osage deaths had often worked for the William J. Burns International Detective Agency before venturing out on their own. Burns, a former Secret Service agent, had succeeded Pinkerton as the world's most celebrated private eye. A short, stout man, with a luxuriant mustache and a shock of red hair, Burns had once aspired to be an actor, and he cultivated a mystique, in part by writing pulp detective stories about his cases. In one such book, he declared, "My name is William J. Burns, and my address is New York, London, Paris, Montreal, Chicago, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Seattle, New Orleans, Boston, Philadelphia, Cleveland, and wherever else a law-abiding citizen may find need of men who know how to go quietly about throwing out of ambush a hidden assassin or drawing from cover criminals who prey upon those who walk straight." Though dubbed a front-page detective for his incessant self-promotion, he had an impressive track record, including catching those responsible for the 1910 bombing of the headquarters of the Los Angeles Times, which killed 20 people. The New York Times called Burns perhaps the only really great detective, the only detective of genius whom this country has produced. And Sir Arthur Conan Doyle gave him the moniker he longed for, America's Sherlock Holmes. Unlike Sherlock Holmes, though, Burns had rigged juries and allegedly kidnapped a suspect, and he routinely used the sordid techniques of imperial spies. After being caught breaking into a New York law office in an attempt to steal evidence, he said,